Welcome to Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm health integrationist Lena Berman, and I come to you weekly to discuss self-care and integrated health. It's an unfortunate characteristic of human nature to ignore health until it's gone. Often it's after receiving a critical diagnosis that people begin to consider how to care for themselves. How we make healthcare decisions draws on our most deep-seated beliefs and fears. It is, in fact, related to how we move in the world and how we make other important decisions. So uncovering and understanding the individual nature of how we make decisions about our healthcare gives us access to who we are and protects us under stress, since part of a healthcare program includes becoming informed. Exploring the science of decision-making illuminates both how we receive information and how the medical establishment dispenses it. Joining me this hour is political economist, consultant, and writer Dr. Jeffrey Fawcett, F-A-W-C-E-T-T. Join us during this hour as we learn how to make healthy medical decisions. Dr. Jeffrey Fawcett is a political economist, a writer, and a consultant. He has a doctorate in political economy and environmental economics from the University of California, and he's currently completing a book for the American Museum of Natural History on phylogenetics, which is evolutionary biology, and is also at work on a book on the diabetes epidemic. Dr. Fawcett has been an instructor at the University of California, a statistician and budget analyst for healthcare organizations, a consultant on quality control systems. He has conducted workshops on business decision processes and consults with individuals and groups on how to make better healthcare and medical decisions. And he's with me in studio today. So welcome to you. Thank you for coming in.
Thank you for having me. This
probably says a lot about who I am, but because of the way I feel about things, I always think that, you know, I think about the relationship between our feelings and our bodies, like the show we did on with Antonio Damasio, where, you know, they're sort of connected up. So I always thought, when I thought about healthcare decisions, that the place to start would be to start with how you feel about your emotional state. You recommend starting with information first. Why is that?
I think that one thing that starting with information does is it gets us, in a sense, outside of our skin. It helps us to grasp the issues that are going on. And medical and health decisions are about making choices. So understanding the choices may help us to have a better grasp of how both how to reason our way through them and how we feel about them, what our emotional responses are to them.
So in other words, what you're saying is that when you focus on the information first, it has a calming effect.
Yes.
And I think most people know this, too. When you're really scared and feeling overwhelmed, sometimes if you just focus on your choices, it sort of quiets some of the noise down. And then the more information you have, the calmer you are, the more you can sort of proceed.
And more broadly, what it helps us do is we feel the way we do because we interact with our environment. That's information coming into us. So what we see literally affects how we feel. So that mountain lion we see, we don't know how to respond to it, whether it's in the zoo or whether it's on the road ahead of us. Do we take the picture or do we run away? Do we respond by fright or do we respond by delight?
So how does that tie in with medical decisions?
Ties in because the situation that we may be faced with, depending on the alternatives that we see before us, we may feel in control or we may feel helpless. We may initially see a situation as one in which we have no control whatsoever or very little control, but by exploring what our options are and what the information is that's presented to us, gain control and improve our ability to grapple with those decisions.
So what you're talking about is sort of moving away from a kind of helpless, overwhelmed state into a state of feeling more confident.
Yes.
Okay.
That's a critical element in health and medical decision making.
Well, we're going to talk, I think, some more about the emotional side of all of this, but I think one of the things that triggers an emotional response, even if the diagnosis maybe isn't a critical diagnosis, even if it's just an inconvenient diagnosis, for instance, you're writing a book on diabetes, somebody finds out they have diabetes, they may not be facing imminent demise. You know, they may not going to feel that they've got less than a few months to live, but it's certainly going to change their lifestyles, and it may be depressing and upsetting. One of the things that's difficult is that your physician is going to kind of come at you with statistics. You want to talk about how those are being offered? I mean, I think one of the things you said to me when we were talking is that doctors are very selective about how much information they give you. They're going to give you information based on their preferences and their belief systems and all of that. So here they are. They come at you with a bunch of statistics, and it sounds very clear from their standpoint. But you say, actually, there's some real problems with statistics.
Yes, the research on this shows that the most typical common way of presenting statistics, but also... Let me back up some. There are kind of two issues that you raised that are of interest for decision making. One is how healthcare professionals present options to you, which I hope is something we can get into, which is a very critical piece of information. But more importantly, specific to how information is presented, research has shown that the common way of presenting information, it is not a form in which we as human beings readily absorb, and that some early research seemed to point to irrationalities in the way people make decisions, which turned out to be a result simply of the way in which information was communicated.
Can you give us an example?
Sure. The example that I found most dramatic in the research that I did was came about because some researchers read an article about blood donors who had been tested for HIV. 24 of the blood donors had tested positive for HIV. 7 of them committed suicide. Statistics killed in this case. What they looked at was what was it these folks might have understood about what that diagnosis meant. They were presented, and what they did was to test how people were informed of diagnoses by going to AIDS counselors. Typically, the way in which information about diagnoses is presented is in what's called probabilities. It's a form of statistics which we commonly see both in terms of diagnoses and in newspapers with regard to you have a 30% chance of having breast cancer if you are on HRT. There's been a whole spate of reports regarding that. It turns out that human beings are not able to think through information presented in that form very, very clearly. But when the information is presented numerically, they're able to immediately grasp what the meaning of it is.
So 1 in 7 or something.
So 1 in 7. So as an example, the three significant statistics in this case, something called test sensitivity, which is how if you test positive, what's the likelihood, what's the probability that the HIV virus is present, and that statistic is 99.8. That's a big number. That's a high number. That's a high confidence level in the reliability of the test. Very sensitive test. Another statistic is the prevalence of HIV, that is, in a population of people, who's going to have it? Well, in this particular kind of population, it's 0.01%. So chances are very slight that someone in that population is going to have. So those two is going to have the virus.
So what you're saying is if you test positive, you have a 99% chance of actually being having a correct diagnosis, but your probability of getting the disease in a normal population is a very small percentage.
It's a very small percentage. So what that looks like it tells us is that if your test comes back positive,
you're out of here.
It's almost certain that
right.
you've got it.
Okay.
Actually, that's wrong.
Okay.
In fact, there is another piece of statistics which is called false positive, which is exactly what it sounds like. It means you tested positive, but you don't have the virus. And that statistic is about 0.01%. So that when people were being counseled based on information that was coming into both the counselors, some of whom were physicians, and to the civilians who were taking it, essentially what they were being told was, oh, your test is positive, this is a very sensitive test, you've almost certainly got the disease. Well, in fact, your chances are 50-50.
Oh, my.
Why is that? It's because of, in the decision-making literature, this is called a base rate fallacy. That's a label. It doesn't really matter to explain what that means. The effect is that if we think through this problem in numbers, I think we can grasp pretty readily what happens and what our risk actually is. How many people actually tested positive out of a large, say, out of a population of 10,000? Two. There's one who actually has the disease, who actually has the virus, and there's one who was a false positive.
Okay.
So your chances were 50-50.
So what we're really saying is that when you're given a diagnosis and somebody's using statistics to push a protocol on you, the first question you have to find out is, what are the chances that this was a false positive, right? What
yes.
other kinds of questions are there for the person who's presenting you with this information? What is your for a patient, this is like the bottom just fell out. So, and it
yes.
isn't just HIV. There's any number of diagnoses
yes.
that can come at you
yes.
when, you know, they say, okay, your LDL cholesterol is a certain level, and you look at your test and it says, you know, you're in this risk factor, and people get very frightened, so here's the drugs. Again, that's again based on statistics, that sort of thing. So what is it that the patient at that point should be doing? I mean, how do you advise people in that situation to start out with?
There are two directions to move in. One is to be clear about asking how frequently people with my symptoms, with my history, diagnosed with a positive test, actually have the condition that you've been diagnosed with. And that relates to another aspect that you raised, talking about risk factors. That, again, risk factors are epidemiologically determined, but epidemiology is statistics.
Mm-hmm.
So that risk factors simply say certain things contribute to a disease, but you are not, you are who you are, and you have the history that you do, and you have the genetics you do, and you have been exposed to the environment that you have. So that depending on what you were diagnosed with, the outcome of that depends heavily on what your specific history is.
So okay, so there's two things that you said. One is that if your doctor is basing you have a positive test, one of the questions to sort of aggress your physician about is there any chance that this is a false positive? What else could be happening?
Right.
What else could be going on here? You know, how possible is it that this is wrong? What else can we look for? And then in terms of just evaluating statistics in general, there's a sort of cynicism that's kind of apt because it is based on statistics, and statistics, as you've just explained, are slippery.
They're slippery, and in fact, this should either reassure us or frighten us, that when folks who do research in this area perform the same similar kinds of tests on physicians as they do on civilians, that physicians are no better at reading statistics than we are.
Yeah.
They get confused by the same by the same stuff, so that they think, oh, this is, you know, this is a highly reliable test, so you've almost certainly got it. That doesn't mean that at all.
Well, that kind of, to me, that kind of, I mean, as soon as you start talking about statistics, my brain shuts down.
And that's the case with most people.
Well, and maybe doctors too.
Yes.
So there's that kind of thing that happens. So it to me, it means that there is a place for having a person to kind of run this stuff by. You know,
yes.
Like when you're terrified, if you have someone to talk to, you can say, okay, this is what they're telling me. What does this mean? And nobody, actually, none of the people that are there in the healthcare situation can help you break that down. So, you know, that, I mean, I guess that's why you're doing what you're doing for a living.
That's why I'm doing what I'm doing.
Okay, let me just ID the show. This is Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm Lena Berman, and I'm in studio with a political economist, writer, and health decision consultant, Dr. Jeffrey Fawcett. His name is F-A-W-C-E-T-T, and we're talking about how people make healthcare decisions. So one problem is this overwhelming thing that comes at you with statistics. But the other thing that comes at you is the doctor's bias in terms of making a diagnosis. Because part of what I heard you say, which is a very important piece, is just because you have a family history of something and you've tested in a provocative way, this still doesn't mean that your own health history, how well you've cared for yourself, what your lifestyle is like, is going to actually influence very strongly the outcome. Because you could have, I mean, you see people in families with all kinds of familial horribleness.
Yes.
They've all got diabetes. Someone's having heart disease at 52 and having different organs removed as time goes on. The other one is not doing that, is treating himself carefully and doing a good dietary change and not having these things. So part of the thing for people to remember to calm themselves down is these numbers and these studies and this research and these probabilities are based on a kind of average or probabilities or, you know, all this kind of, and that can be broken down. And then you have to look at who you actually are, and then you have to look at how your doctor, how his preference is going to work.
You
know, how frightened he's going to be of malpractice here.
Yes. you raised two extremely important issues. The first is, I couldn't agree with you more, that I like to say that the world's foremost authority on your health is you. Now, a doctor may be an expert in certain areas, but you have the capability, and we each of us have the capability of being the authority on our health. We know what's going on in our body. It's also true that doctors, just like everyone else, think in certain ways, and there are things that make them uncomfortable and things that do not. One of the things that studies have shown is that doctors, like everyone, make decisions in kind of two ways. One way is what I like to call pattern recognition. It's just you see a set of symptoms and the diagnosis comes immediately out of it.
It looks like a chicken. It flaps like a chicken. It clucks.
Yeah, it's got to be
a chicken.
It's a chicken. Yeah, it's out there. The other way is what I like to call deliberation. That is, these are novel symptoms. I haven't seen this before, or I'm unfamiliar with it. I'm going to have to go off and look at it. I'm going to have to evaluate what these symptoms mean, evaluate the different possibilities for diagnosis and treatment, and go through a very conscious process of evaluating.
Typically,
they don't have time, but in addition, there's to kind of link back to both thought processes, information that's coming in, and kind of what I think of as the third side of this issue is emotion, is that doctors feel comfortable with what they know.
Okay.
So that where doctors will tend towards is pattern recognition, typified by the take two aspirin and call me in the morning.
Well, the other thing is, if you go to a surgeon, he's going to suggest surgery.
Yes.
If you go to an internist, he's going to suggest some medications.
Yes.
You know, if you go.
Yes.
To go to a psychiatrist, they're going to suggest, you know. So, yeah, in fact, there's studies on that, too. There was something else that you mentioned to me. You gave me some materials to read, which is the overconfidence bias. Am I jumping ahead too far?
No, overconfidence bias links up heavily with it. It's actually connected with that idea of it is linked somewhat to this idea of how we feel about decisions that we make. The overconfidence bias is a label for a phenomenon which has been shown to occur considerably through all sorts of decision-making situations, including medical decision-making. And what it says is that if the way the test works is if you have to make a choice between multiple options, one thing or another, and then are subsequently asked, how confident are you in your answer, 20% or 40%, up to 100% confident? Then we go back and do this over a whole, test this over a whole bunch of people, and then look at how people answered. If you take a slice, all the people who said they were 100% confident in their answer, it turns out that they were only 80% of them were right in their answer.
Right, people think too much of their own kind of opinions.
Well, because we're asking about what's your emotional state with regard to, we're kind of mixing apples and oranges. We're not asking, based on your knowledge, what is the frequency
right.
with which your selection, your decision, your choice is correct. We're asking, how do you feel about the choice that you just made?
So you were talking about the studies that were done where they asked people, what's the biggest city in the United States or something?
Yes, the classic study is to have two cities, select the one which is the largest, and then put a confidence level on your answer, and it's very consistent, and that occurs with both physician. Well, with any professional,
so what happens really is that when people are asked a question without realizing it, a lot of the answer is coming from an emotional place instead of a knowledge-based place.
And it is coming as much from an emotional place, because one of the things that emotions do is they focus our attention on particular kinds of information, and they also focus our attention on particular ways of making a decision. They may focus our attention that we have to make a decision right now, as opposed to, this is not something that I have to worry about right now. I have lots of time to explore alternatives.
Well, yeah, the other thing about overconfidence is not only is the doctor overconfident, I've seen this before, like you said, the pattern
yes.
recognition, and also I'm a doctor. I'm an expert. You're a patient. So I know, and so they're confident, and they have this emotional impart. And really, supposedly, what's happening is you're supposed to be getting all this information. One of the things you told me, which really made my mouth sort of hang open, is that there's articles about the fact that doctors can be punished for giving a diagnosis to someone who doesn't have the insurance to cover the treatment.
This was actually from a survey of doctors, and the question that they asked them was, do you limit the number of options or recommended treatments that you propose to patients based on their insurance? And if a treatment is not covered by insurance, many doctors will not even bring it up as an option.
Well, and they're not going to bring up alternative options for the same reason, that they're not familiar with it, so it's not within their purview. But the other thing that's interesting here is that this is not just this overconfidence bias also can be a limiting factor for a patient.
Yes.
Because what I see in my practice is somebody comes in, they've gotten a really scary diagnosis. One of the things that's happening is they're terrified because the doctor is telling them, well, you just have to do this thing, and they're rushing them, they're pressuring them, they're saying, you have to make a decision, we have to get this done, we have to do that. So that's another thing that we should talk about, is this pressuring. The other thing is that the patient is coming into the situation with a whole belief system.
Yes.
Either they really believe in conventional medicine or they really disbelieve. So sometimes when they show up in my office, they don't believe in conventional medicine, but they really believe in some minutia about unconventional, and they're kind of throwing everything in, but they have a very strong, and you're talking to them and nothing is getting in. you know, I'm talking to them about something, and they're not here. And finally, I just sort of put my hand up and I say, listen, let's just have an agreement. I'm going to give you information because I'm a health educator. I'm not going to tell you what to do. I'm going to just give you a bunch of information because that's what I'm here for. And
right.
then, you know, don't reject it. Just listen. And then later, go home and review it. So an overconfidence bias is a problem for a patient as well.
Yes. And particularly in conventional, well, particularly in conventional medicine, but no doubt in alternative medicines as well, that there is a kind of social contract that we walk into. There's a set of expectations about who's the expert. There's a and that is a very broad issue, but just in terms of the dynamic between patient and doctor, that what you were noting is an outcome of doctors being one up, patients being one down.
And then if you have a patient who's part of a even one down social class,
yes.
they're even one down down.
Yes, and that reinforces a whole lot of things. Reinforces that one up, one down, and it elicits from us certain emotional states, how we feel about ourselves, both from the doctor's standpoint and our standpoint, and expectations about what we're going to get from the other. The doctor expects compliance from patients. When it's not received, he thinks patients are irrational. And patients want the truth from doctors.
Yeah, they get mad when doctors say, I don't know.
And if doctors start giving them options, they get uncomfortable.
Yeah, so it's a real catch-22.
Yes.
The other thing that you told me is that people also need to kind of review what they believe constitutes health. And it is, you know, that seems very, you know, but it's so different. You know, I'll have people come in my office, they'll say, I'm really healthy. And then I look at the health questionnaire I've
yes.
given them. And there's just this wrong. And then, but they have this idea that they're, you know, so it's how does that, you know, so. We're getting close to needing to take a break, but let's see. I'm trying to think of something small we can bring up. I was talking about how much people are pressured to make fast decisions. Would you agree that the first step is to put your hands up and say, hold it?
Just, absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And to give a brief answer, one of the things that the research shows is that we have innate mechanisms for making decisions, coming to decisions, and doing it. And those have been developed to make decisions given limited time and limited information. And those things are triggered by our environment. And so the first thing to do is slow things down enough, maybe not to change strategies, but to at least be conscious of the strategies that we are following.
Yeah, that seems really important. And that's the same kind of advice I would give somebody in a hot emotional moment, is
yes.
to slow things down. We need to take a short break. I'm Lena Berman. This is Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm live in the studio with Dr. Jeffrey Fawcett, who is discussing how people make medical decisions. He is a consultant and a writer. We are going to take a brief break. Please stay with us. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm health integrationist Lena Berman. I'm in the studio with Dr. Jeffrey Fawcett. It's F-A-W-C-E-T-T. He is in the context of our conversation today, he is a consultant on healthy medical decision making. And I believe you are making your services available to the listening audience. Do you want to give out a phone number?
Yes, it's area code 707-874-1496.
You should always do that twice.
I will.
Okay.
707-874-1496. 1496.
So you're available as a consultant for clients?
Yes, for individuals and groups.
Okay. If you miss parts of today's show and you want to get a cassette copy of this or any other in the series, Your Own Health and Fitness, or if you need to reach me, you can call my information number 24 hours at 707-874-2772, 874-2772. Or you can go to the website, yourownhealthandfitness.com. So we were talking about in the face of the stress and the pressure, the fear, the statistics, all this overwhelming material, and the doctor is climbing down your throat, you have to have surgery now, you have to start taking this medication now, we don't have time, to just for yourself and for the situation, slow things down and take a time out. You used the term, you said that we take our clues from our environment. It also strikes me that we have accumulated information. I'm sure that you have experiences with clients where you see this happen, but an example is yesterday I was sitting outside reading your material, and there was a yellow jacket, and I leave them alone. I don't mess with yellow jackets, but this one, for, I have to say, no particular reason, just decided to sting me, give me a little sting, and it was enormously painful, and I could actually consciously feel myself flipping through this little file folder in my head. Oh, let's see, baking soda, Apis, homeopathic remedy, Apis, you know, and then I went down to get a book and looked up some other remedies. Oh, vitamin C, 10,000 milligrams of vitamin C, but it was based on not only my beliefs on how to treat things, you know, I didn't think hydrocortisone, I didn't think that first, I thought natural remedies, so that's my bias, and then I started to go through the things in my brain that I already had as accumulated knowledge. So when you say the environment, are you talking about the bee coming at me? Is that the first? Is that what you meant by the environment?
Well, the bee certainly got your attention.
Yeah.
And it certainly elicited an emotional response. And it got your attention focused on what to do. And you immediately recognized a pattern. Remember, I was referring to what doctors do or what we all do. We recognize a pattern. And based on that pattern, you focused your attention on immediately what to do about it. You were not thinking about fixing dinner or about this show. You no doubt immediately stopped thinking about what it was you're reading. So that's the interplay of your environment with what you're feeling, how you're solving a problem, and what information is relevant to solving that health situation, that health crisis that you faced. You were calling upon information that you already had, and you could have, perhaps, done some deliberation and...
I did it after I did some initial stuff.
So in the aftermath, you started exploring some other things, but your response was very much like what I was describing as pattern recognition. It feels like a yellow jacket. Let's get some stuff going here.
How do we? Because that sort of situation, although it was an emergency situation, is not terribly serious. I mean, I've had situations where I've advocated for people in emergency rooms. I had a famous thing happen where I was with somebody who had an appendicitis and they wanted a cut. And I said, no, I don't think so. I think we're going to treat this with antibiotics, because I did some research very quickly before I left for the hospital. And it was very difficult because there's this whole standard of care thing coming at you, and the doctors were appalling. They were, I mean, never mind bedside manner. I mean, they were saying, he's going to die, you have to sign all these papers. It was enormously frightening and upsetting, and I had to keep saying quietly, no, we're going to wait a day or two, we're going to wait 24 hours, we're going to try this, we're going to wait, you know, and this, that, and they're telling you to, you know. In that situation, this business of looking at your alternatives is under pressure, looking at alternatives when your brain is exploding. Can you talk a little bit about that? How to evaluate stuff? How do you look at what might be the right information versus, you know, stuff's coming at you, you're scared. You know, you're trying to slow yourself down.
I think the first thing to, the first place not to go is that because you are afraid, you are irrational.
That's a good point.
The fear is rational.
is
quite rational. Yeah. You are in that situation. You are in a very dangerous situation. And again, this idea of your emotions are helping you, are actually integral to your selecting out what's the right information that I need right now. Part of the fear, but the other part of this is to be present with the fear and not overwhelmed by it. The idea is not to be unemotional about these decisions. The idea is to be present with your emotions.
To use that as one of the things that you're looking at in terms of choice.
Yes.
I do not want to have surgery. He's saying I need it. I don't want it. So that's an important piece of information.
Yes. And I guess another way to... One concept that might be useful here is in the decision-making literature, they use the concept of frames. It means how do you frame the problem so that when we go into a doctor's office, when we're presented with an emergency room situation, that brings up for us a whole set of ideas about a whole way of thinking about what situation are we in. So that one of the things I like to suggest to people is that when they think about their exchanges with physicians, that indeed they are experts, they are highly trained, but MD does not mean minor deity.
Well, they've not lived in your body.
They have not lived in your body.
They don't
know what your values are, so that. As your attitude towards a doctor should be, they are there to help you. They are there to help you achieve your health goals.
Well, they certainly have seen some things you haven't seen, so they can give you their opinion.
Yes. So that it's kind of a touchy situation because, in a way, by doing that, by treating the doctor as, in a way, a contractor... A professional who is helping you achieve your goals, you're redefining the conventional relationship between you and the doctor. And the doctor is likely to resist.
Yes.
And then they might resist because they're having their own emotional response to this, or they might be resisting just because they don't get it quite. And then some physicians will accept it readily, will accept that relationship readily.
You know, one of the things that we're thinking about here, too, is that we're talking about unpacking a bunch of stuff because you've got both this emotional situation coming up, this fear and various things and dread and examining your preferences and all these kind of things. And then you've got sort of cognitive stuff. You've got how you think things through and how you look at statistics and getting more information.
Yeah, what I call the strategy that you follow in... figuring out what you do.
How much time are you going to take to look at research? When do you decide you should stop looking at research and do something? You know, that kind of thing. When you're dealing with emotions, there's a bunch of stuff in the literature that you gave me that talks about the different ways that we, I guess for lack of a better word, unpack our emotions. And one of the things that's really interesting is the, looking at, well, for instance, one of them is you say something about the obviously better solution versus the better in light of how I'm feeling now.
Yes.
So want to say something about that?
What this is about in terms of how we, again, this is part of how emotions in our emotional state helps us to make decisions because it... what we're presented with is, in some instances, obvious choices, as opposed to this kind of notion that in making decisions we should be cool and calm, and this odd notion of rationality as being dispassionate. In my view, there is no such thing as a dispassionate thought. And there is no such thing as a thoughtless passion. They are intertwined, inextricable. I can say that.
Easy for you to say.
Yeah, they're all together. You know that thing. They're all connected.
Well, this is very much like Damasio, and it's interesting that, you know, one thing I know about you is you studied philosophy a lot, and that you were a big fan of Spinoza. And when I told you I was reading this stuff about Spinoza, you got very excited because of the thing. So there's something very Spinozian about all of this, too.
Exactly, and Damasio's work is really wonderful in this. Just in terms of certainly Western culture since the Enlightenment, since the 17th century, the dominant view of how human beings work is that there's this world of the mind and there's the world of the body, and that the two are entirely separate kinds of things. And what has dominated our culture has been the scientific method, the development of science, the scientific revolution. And that has been enabled by that view that there is the world and objects, and then there is how we experience it. The thing that Spinoza did and that Damasio is doing is saying, no. The mind and the body are only two aspects of the same thing. And decision-making is very much of a kind. There's an information part. There is the strategies that you follow in making decisions. And there's the emotional part. And those are not separate entities. Those are things which are all intertwined and integral to each other. It's not, you need to make, in order to make rational health decisions, you need to divorce yourself from all this emotional stuff that's going on with you and evaluate the options and make reasonable decisions and probabilities and blah, 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 blah. That's not how it works.
So go back to obviously better versus better in light of, because there's that kind of, you're in an emotional state, and sometimes the part of you that's the loudest in a situation like that is really little and helpless and scared, and then there's a part that's more grown up and saying, oh, but, you know. So how do you...
This is related to the issue we were talking about earlier about slowing down, because an option, a choice, may seem obviously better, but when you slow down and understand that maybe you become focused on one particular thing, it may not be the obvious choice. It may require you to look at other choices.
And then there's also that kind of long-term versus short-term strategies, you know, which is what people know about through Daniel Goleman's work on emotional intelligence, that you sometimes make a decision that's going to have a long-term better effect instead of, you know, you've been diagnosed with cancer and you've decided to do alternative things to slow the cancer growth down, but right now you want a candy bar, and candy and sugar feed cancer cells. So short-term gratification, well, I've got cancer and I should be able to do what I want, versus, but I may beat the cancer and I'm not going to do it eating sugar.
Those are very tough problems to solve. Because it works both ways. We may adopt a long-term strategy for health that, when we're actually in a situation that presents a temptation, our emotional state may overwhelm us.
So are you saying it's good to have, even before you get a bad diagnosis, maybe just in terms of health decision hygiene, that people really ought to examine some of these issues, like maybe even use a consultant like you, examine some of these issues ahead of time when they're not in a critical situation so that they have a better sense of what their values are and what their general attitudes are about all this?
Yes. There's another area of research in this regarding decision-making that is focuses more on long-term, that what we've been talking about is kind of individual, discrete decisions. I'm faced with a diagnosis. What do I do? This other body of research called self-regulation looks at how people make decisions in the context of their having a sense of themselves.
Mm, boy. Very difficult.
And how those individual decisions contribute to that, that sense of oneself, and how those decisions come out of that. And we can see almost directly in this what that relationship is, because your sense of yourself in health decision situation is going to have a lot to do with what information is valid, who you're going to believe, how you're going to make the decision.
Yeah, how are you going to let it in stuff? It's going back to the overconfidence bias. It's how much are you letting in?
Cause
you have to be able to. I want you to talk a little bit about the cognitive unconscious. Oh, let me just remind people, you're listening to Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm Lena Berman, and I'm live in the studio with Dr. Jeffrey Fawcett, F-A-W-C-E-T-T. He is a consultant to individuals and groups on how to make medical decisions, and his number is 707-874-1496, in the 707. He's available as a consultant. Cognitive unconscious. I underlined it, not deliberate or even conscious, the sort of part of decision-making.
Yes, we've already talked about...
Oh, did we?
Yeah, well, we've touched on some of the features here. The whole idea of recognizing a set of symptoms and immediately going to a diagnosis, of framing certain situations.
Oh, the places walking, where you just snap into something.
Where you simply recognize where you are, how we think, what's important, what's not important. A good deal of what we do when we're problem solving goes on below the surface. And part of what I try to do with people is to slow things down enough so that you can really be deliberate about the decisions that we're making.
We've talked some about how the patient and the doctor interact, and who's one up, who's down, who's one down, and the risks, you know, someone might take in trying to change that relationship, the risks and having your doctor be critical or whatever, and how you have to kind of stay with yourself and know who you are and have that sense of yourself. It might also be useful to talk a little bit about what to do in light of the fact that this is something that's very close to my heart, that every time you open the newspaper, like you were talking about these hormone studies, you know, every time you open the newspaper, there is this research that looks very conclusive that all hormones are bad for you. And they're not talking about all hormones. They're not talking about bioidentical hormones. They're not talking about the research that's been done on those. So, you know, so it's the research that both the doctor is being fed by the pharmaceutical companies and by his journals, and then the research that's also there, which I try to present on the air, and how people sort of unwind these conflicting research issues, how hard that is.
It is hard. One of the principal reasons is a kind of nexus around the conventions around reporting. Medical reporters are literally that. They are reporting results that they're being told. They are not analyzing them. So that when you read those reports in the newspaper, they're being told the results without asking, more or less uncritically. They might present contrasting views, but that's typically all that you're going to see, is a contrasting view. So that in terms of how studies are actually done and what they mean, it is not transparent at all. For instance, we've talked about this spate of HRT studies that have come out of England recently, and what they do and don't mean. So far as I can tell from looking at these results, they all have to do with pharmaceutical HRT. None of the tests have to do with using natural hormones, which is huge. That is a huge issue in terms of just the test design.
Well, not only but the other thing about the test design is that they never test these women to see whether they need hormones. They often give for instance, estrogen to a woman who's estrogen dominant.
Yes.
And then they give them synthetic progestin. So one of the things I learned, that people have heard me use this expression on the air, and I got it from you, is when you look at a research project, you have to look and get a sense of how the questions were asked.
That's right.
So explain that a little bit to people.
Any clinical trial, examination, takes a population that is supposedly randomly selected. That makes statistically it valid. But random simply means that you have some method for picking people and testing for one thing. The standard scientific method is to change one variable and see what happens without examining all the other environmental factors that could affect people. So that the gold standard, so-called, of double-blind random tests may not be asking the whole question.
It's not controlling for variables the way that real life does.
When you read the results and see that you have 30%.
Again, with the statistics,
right? One of the things that comes up in statistical analyses is what is called explained and unexplained variation, which means if I twiddle this one thing, if I compare women who are under HRT and those who are not, what do I see in terms of cardiovascular disease? We've twiddled only one thing.
Yeah, we don't know what the other things are.
We have to assume that all the other possible variables that will affect that outcome are the same in both populations. And sometimes we don't know that because we don't know what all the factors are.
Plus, they also make conclusions in research projects. You read just the conclusions, and the conclusions don't match the research. Like, there'll be, and George is nodding with a big grin on his face. If you go back and read the full research project, you'll realize that things came up in the research that they don't like, and they'll say at the end, "No, that's anomalous. It's weird. Yeah. That's not true. We still conclude the same thing."
I
want to make sure we talk about this other last thing, but go ahead. Okay.
Well, I was just going to interject. Yeah, I was having a conversation with John Lee in which he said even more dramatically that sometimes you will read an abstract in the conclusions, and when you actually read the research itself,
says something different.
It doesn't support the conclusion
right?
that they come to.
Right. He's talking about Dr. John Lee, the hormone writing doc. Economics. You're an economist. You started as an environmental economist. So one of the biggest things I hear from people over and over again, and it is, I have to say, despite the occasional calls that I get from people saying, well, you just did a show on all these vitamins, and I can't afford the vitamins. I'm on disability, and I don't have the... Well, despite the fact that it may seem like I'm only advocating things that cost money, the truth is the reason I do the show as a volunteer at the station is because I want to get as much information out to the public that doesn't cost them money so that they can try some things on their own. But it is inevitable that people have to figure out what their priorities are if their income is low, if they're from a disadvantaged population and they don't have insurance. Well, actually, insurance doesn't cover anything anymore anyway that you can use, as far as I can tell. So how do you advise people on what to do if they're in financial straits and they're trying to deal with their health?
Let me give an immediate, my immediate response is support universal health care. But beyond that, I think there are two things that we can do. I was recently reading an article about malnourishment, starvation in the United States. And in the course of describing this, they're talking about, as journalistically they do, some elderly people who had to make the choice between purchasing pharmaceuticals and buying food. It's absurd. And my thought is, why aren't we advising people on alternatives to taking the drugs? Do they need to take the drugs at all?
And might there be food solutions
and
that
might
would
there
be
corrective? Nutritional, exactly, nutritional solutions. My other thought is a fairly simple one, which is write up a budget. Where's your money going?
Are you paying car payments, or are you paying for your good, healthy food?
And it is kind of full circle. It's back to that information of having everything. What are your options? What is before you? Making priorities and making a reasonable decision.
I want to really thank you. This was really stimulating.
Thank you.
Dr. Jeffrey Fawcett, F-A-W-C-E-T-T. He is a consultant to individuals and groups on how to make medical decisions. He has a very, if you get the tape and listen to the show, you'll hear the beginning where he find out how he's all these other things, too. He has a doctorate in political economy and on and on. But for you, you can reach him at 707-874-1496, 707-874-1496 on a consulting basis to groups and individuals. I want to thank everyone for listening. I'm Lena Berman. If you need more information or you want a cassette copy of this show or any other in the series, Your Own Health and Fitness, you can dial my information number 24 hours. It's 707-874-2772, 707-874-2772. For a list of other available shows, go to the website, yourownhealthandfitness.com, yourownhealthandfitness.com. Next week, a show about non-pharmaceutical solutions to hypertension, another nutrition-based illness. The engineer for Your Own Health and Fitness on the Sebastopol side is George Curtis at the Powerhouse Brewery. Thank you to Johnny Otis in the Powerhouse. I'm Lena Berman. Your Own Health and Fitness is produced by Free Speech Radio, KPFA FM 94.1. Remember, being informed not only protects your health, it protects your freedom. See you next week.